It's old school, 100.3. Good morning. Court Radio is now in session. Call 215-263-1003. When you've got legal questions, we've got the answers. This is Court Radio. And now, here's your host, Dean Weitzman.
Good morning and welcome to Court Radio. You know what to do. If you've got legal questions, we've got legal answers. All you have to do is give us a call at 215-263-1003. And I and my co-host, the one and only David M. Rappaport.
Good morning. How are you? Whoa, where your ears are blown away now.
I'm going to have a work injury from frequently having excessive volume in my headset.
Well, good morning and happy Father's Day.
I think this, maybe I can bring a claim against the studio.
I'll represent you.
This switch, I think, needs indents. It's a loose switch, and it just slides gently up the scale until my ears are bleeding.
We will own old school.
That's right. We will. And then
fire
with,
Kyle.
With old school comes Kyle.
Right.
So that's a win-win. All right, folks. This is Court Radio, and we're already grabbing calls. 215-263-1003. If you've been sitting on your important legal question for David and I throughout the week, now's the time to give us a call. We'll give it our best shot. There's some interesting stories, legal stories in the news this week, David.
Well, first, we have to mention the U.S. Open, right?
I was there. You
in
were
Marion.
There?
No, yeah. I was not there.
You were not there. I was there. Here's my report from the U.S. Open, okay? And maybe this is just me. This is Dean, okay? I'll give you a little glimpse into my
You're not
personality.
I'm not a crazed golfer.
I'm not a crazed anything. It has to be enjoyable.
Right.
So it has to be better than, significantly better than watching it on TV.
In a relaxed, lounging position.
Exactly. Right.
Right.
That's why you don't see me at too many football games. Because it gets too chilly. It's a little too windy. You know, I want the perfect environment. And I don't want somebody next to me screaming too loud.
Okay. And you went to the wrong
and dripping event. Dripping beer on me and stuff like that. No. All right. U.S. Open. 25,000 people they let in a day, okay? They have what they call cattle. Cattle chutes, cattle paths.
Whatever. It's your cattle, basically.
Right, exactly. You get to cross the greens in certain areas.
Right, right.
Okay, so 25,000 people a day are crossing in the same specified area.
Right.
And it rained like a mother the day before.
Oh, so I already can feel the mud.
Yeah, it was like Woodstock in the 60s, where you know bodies were just sliding in mud. That was the U.S. So you saw the pristine golfers in their whites.
Well, yeah, white.
Looking perfect. Right. And then you had the people watching them that were being, you know, like attacked by mosquitoes and crossing swampy, muddy junk. And, you know, and as you, I was lucky enough. The nicest thing about going to the U.S. Open, I actually purchased a car from a dealership that was nearby, and they let me drop my car at their lot, shuttled me to the U.S. Open.
That's why it was fairly enjoyable for
me. It was. Because otherwise, the instructions were to park at the blue lot. The blue lot, folks, you ready for this? The blue lot. It's at the Delaware Memorial Bridge. And then you take a shuttle for 35 minutes. To get to the U.S.
Good
Open.
Good God.
No.
And then all those cattle...
I didn't even see Tiger Woods.
No, you can't even see any golfers.
No, I didn't see him. I heard the crowd roar for him for like a putt
something. You don't want to see him. He's out of it. But
yeah, how far back is he?
He's done. He was like nine over or something. But Phil Mickelson ended with one under, I think.
Well, it's Sunday. Aren't they playing today?
Yeah, today's the last day.
Okay, so what do you mean he ended? Oh, he ended yesterday with one.
There's no way. Look, if Tiger ended up winning, would be the most amazing comeback.
But Mickelson may not win.
Well, Mickelson is known. Look, I like Phil Mickelson, but he's known as a big choker. So he may not win.
Eek.
Now, it used to be, you know, when Tiger got to this position, you knew he would win.
Right.
It was almost a given. That's not really the case with Phil Mickelson.
As I was walking along the course, there was cameras everywhere. And so there was this little guy who pops up with a giant camera in front of him, and he's broadcasting from the U.S. Open to Ireland. And it was really funny to see him with his Irish accent and exclaiming that he's in Philadelphia watching the U.S. Open.
I am in Philadelphia. What's great about this U.S. Open in Marion, it was 32 years ago that it was there. What's great about it is this course is so hard, and sometimes they're not as hard as this one, but if you watch it on TV and you're a golfer, you'll see these really, really good golfers, Tiger, all of them, making shots that you would make, you know, like you, Dean, I've golfed with you. You know, you get up there and you hit, and it goes 4 feet, you know, and you see them do that because the rough is so hard to hit out of that they're, you know, they're duffing shot. They're like not even hitting the ball. They're hitting it. It goes 2 feet to the left. It's kind of reassures you that, hey, these guys can do that as well.
Right.
Imagine us playing that course. We wouldn't break 200. I mean, it's really hard. It's almost impossible.
But yeah, well, who would want to belong to a course then? It's almost impossible.
You know what? That's an interesting question.
So that every Sunday you go out to golf.
And you want to kill yourself.
You want to kill yourself.
Yeah, I agree with you. There is a level of...
I would never join Marion. Nah. Is that the name of the Marion Golf Course?
Yeah, well, it's very exclusive, by the way. So.
Is it? Well, they probably wouldn't have me then.
They may not.
Wink, wink. The other thing is the neighbors. You would think Marion, you know, these are high-browed neighbors, right. You know, well-heeled neighbors. These guys are hawking parking spaces at their homes. Okay,
a
house leading up to the golf course.
Wouldn't you though? They're making money.
No.
Big money.
No. I don't want strangers parking on my property. But these guys are like, yo, come here. I'll give you my parking spot, $30.
Parking spot? People rented their houses, mostly to golfers, though. You could rent your house to a golfer and make a lot of money, but you have to leave your house.
Yeah, well, maybe these were like the crew of golfers, because they did have like Southern accents, and they were like...
The crew, like the entourage.
The entourage was selling parking spaces at the houses that the golfers were renting.
Wow. So it's like the renters making money from what they rented.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a little crazy.
215-263-1003.
Enough of Marion, right?
Yeah. Enough of U.S. Open. Let's talk legal for a minute here. We got a judge rules that it's illegal to not pay interns.
Oh.
That's going to affect the radio station, don't you think, Kyle?
Well, it's not here. Where is, what state
federal
is
district
that?
Federal.
Federal. Oh, federal, okay.
Federal district judge in Manhattan ruled on Tuesday that Fox Searchlight Pictures violated federal and New York minimum wage laws by not paying production interns, case that could have long-standing impact in the industry. Both music, movies, radio, because they all, you know, want to get free work. I wouldn't even feel having somebody come in and work for free. It's despicable. But the interns want to do it because they say, hey, look, we're getting experience. You know, of course, they rarely get a job from that. But, you know, the point is that this is a for-profit enterprise.
Yeah,
right?
But, you know, we like to, as lawyers, distinguish cases. And it looks to me like there were two key points. One that you mentioned, the studio benefited from their work a lot. But the other one was it really wasn't an educational environment. You know, they were using them to go fetch coffee probably and do things that really wasn't furthering their education, which then sort of says if you're using an intern and you're not doing that, then you should be paying them. They're working for you.
Yeah.
You know, they're not getting a benefit for their education.
And all they had to do was pay them the minimum wage.
Oh, right.
You know, what are they saving, really?
Oh, and they're probably making
Fox.
Billions.
Yeah. It's Fox, those, you know, right-wing Republican.
Yeah, they're making billions a year spewing forth inaccuracies and no facts about what's going on in our world. So.
Well, we don't have news anymore. You know, the only news we have is the news you and I provide.
Yeah, right.
Well-researched.
Yes.
Deep news. Okay, let's talk to Annie, or Ann, from North Philly. Good morning and welcome to Core Radio.
Good morning. How are you?
We're doing well, thanks. And what's your question, Ann?
I found an apartment that I would like to rent. And I was informed that the landlord doesn't have a rental license. And I'm supposed to get what they call a rental suitability certificate.
Okay.
Is it illegal to rent, or can I still rent that without the consequences of whatever?
The consequences befall the landlord, yeah. Not you.
I don't think it's illegal.
And he or she might find it rather difficult. They won't be able to get into court to evict you until they get a license. So the courts and the city limit their rights as landlords when they're not paying for the rental license. Ultimately, landlords who don't have rental licenses frequently will get one just before they go to court if there's a problem with a tenant. But you should be fine if you're renting and he doesn't have a license.
No, I'm considering renting the unit. So, I mean, would it be okay to rent it even though he doesn't have a license?
Well, if you this certificate that you're talking about that they said you needed, I've actually never heard of. But if there is such a certificate, then that seems to
get a suitability.
Yeah, that seems to be the way that the city handles getting around the fact that there's no what they probably do is issue you that certificate and then give the landlord a particular period of time to get their license. Really, the issue is the license is to make sure that it's suitable and that they're qualified. So
yeah, because the certificate of suitability that says that they're supposed to do an inspection, and that comes from license and inspection they give the landlord to give to the tenant before they rent it.
Okay. Well, considering what's been going on in our city with licenses and inspections, that might be a little tricky.
Yeah, well, the truth of the matter is, I don't think... and you know, maybe somebody from license and inspections can set me straight, but I doubt very much whether L and I comes out to every apartment, every single apartment that's rented,
and
does an on-site inspection.
No way. In fact, I've done licenses for people. You know, it's just you go to the municipal services building and fill an application. They've never gone out and inspected the property.
Okay. Yeah.
So all right, well, it's a nice spot, so, you know, I'm going to go ahead and
Just make sure you have a proper lease and all the terms are written down that you want and you understand it and, you know, do the right thing.
Okay, thank you.
All right, take care. Have a great Sunday.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, let's talk to Dean from Overbrook Park.
Hello?
Hey, good morning.
Yeah, hi. As irony would have it, my question is about rental license fees, too.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can.
We hear you just fine.
All right.
Is your name really Dean? Is your name
Hello?
Is your name really Dean?
Dean.
Dean, wow. Isn't that a coincidence that my name is Dean and your name is Dean?
It is. I didn't. I've never heard your show before. I just happened to be listening.
Oh, first
to the
time.
Radio when it came on.
Wow.
Dun, 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 first
That's
time
really
call.
The only reason I picked you was because your name was Dean. So you
well,
should
anyways,
you should thank mom and
I
dad for that.
I own a 2-apartment duplex.
Okay.
And I've owned it since 2006. And the city has never sent me a bill to pay the rental fee. You know, the annual rental fee is like $50 or $60.
Right.
So anyway, I paid it. I think the first year, but anyway, I got a big warning saying that I haven't paid my rental license fee for, you know, about 6 years in a row, and they want me to pay like $600. And so, I went to the hearing, and they denied me because my argument was if I never got a bill, how would I know what to pay, when to pay? Because it went actually in that time frame, it went from $50 to $60. Here in Philadelphia, and I also said like it's a little like a water bill or any other bill that you get from the city. They send you a bill and you pay it, but I've never been sent anything.
Well, it's not really
this big warning. So now I appealed the judgment of the hearing officer, and I haven't heard from them in months. So I'm just wondering, do I have any legal recourse? Am I legally required to pay these back years?
Yes. First of all, it's not a bill. You're paying for the right to be licensed to rent the property. So you know, we like to say, I'm sure you've heard the saying that comes from lawyers and from, actually, most people know this, ignorance of the law is not a defense, okay? And you are, it's incumbent upon you as a landlord to make sure that you have the proper licensing. So the fact that they didn't send you the bill, I don't think really means much to your obligation. Now, it may be, you may be able to get a payment plan or some type of way to get to be able to pay it over time, but you're obligated to pay it. You have to do it. You need a license to rent property.
Do you have any clue as to why they don't send the notice like they do property taxes or water or gas or
do they generally not send notices, or is it that you didn't get one, and maybe they don't. I'm not sure because I've never rented property in the city. But you know what happens is, like anything else, when your license expires, okay, when your driver's license expires, when your registration, well, not registration, but when they usually send you a form to re-up.
Yeah, but if they don't.
But if they don't, and you're driving around with a suspended license or an expired license, you're still in violation of the law. You have an obligation to look down at that license as well and say, "Oops, my license is coming up for expiration. I got to figure this out. I got to get a new one." So it's a two way.
You know that the state of Pennsylvania always sends you the notice.
I do.
That your registration is due.
But you also realize you won't argue with me that if for some reason you don't get it, but it is expired, that you have an obligation to seek it out yourself.
That's true.
All right.
So
thank
you're
you. That's it.
I got to pay $600 because they never send me notice.
Yes. But because they didn't, and you seem like a nice guy and your name is Dean, they'll probably work a payment plan out with you, but you're not going to get off scot-free.
No.
All right, Dean, have a happy Father's Day, and thanks for calling Court Radio. Folks, if you're listening to David and I, you can reach us quickly, easily. Well, maybe not quickly or easily. The lines are lit. 215-263-1003. David, we're going to move on to our hot button topic.
Hot button.
And we're going to transition. We're going to segue.
Let's segue.
Yeah, we have to. We have on the line the one and only Tom Klein from the famous the famous Klein and Spector law firm. Hello, Tom.
Spector and Klein Law Firm.
Yeah, Spector and Klein. You say that, but that's not true, folks.
No, and I'm reading. You know, we got a bio, Tom. Like we needed this, right? We got a bio, and it says that for 10 consecutive years, you were rated as the number one attorney in Pennsylvania by Super Lawyers. But I wonder what Shane thinks about that.
he thinks he is, and rightfully so.
Well, I was going to say though. I don't take much credence in these things usually, but in this instance, it happens to be probably true that at least both of you are probably, the number one lawyers in Philadelphia.
I've been very proud that our peers recognize us.
Absolutely.
My law partner, Shane Spector, has been recognized that way for many, many years as a top lawyer in the state. And we're proud of what we do in terms of safety reforms and in terms of having people compensated for their injuries.
Absolutely.
Happy Father's Day, Tom.
Yes.
On a different note.
Thank you. I'm headed after this to see my two grandchildren. So it's a big day. Father's Day is a big day in the Klein household.
All right.
There you go. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about some myths in medical malpractice. There was an article written in a journal. What's the significance, first of all, of an article in this particular journal about medical malpractice?
Well, first of all, and can you all hear me?
Yes,
we can.
Hear
you just fine.
Okay, that's great. There's been a debate for many years, actually a lot of propaganda by insurance industry, by the corporate interests, by those who don't want to see people adequately or fairly compensated. And there's been all kinds of things propagated. We all are well familiar with the McDonald's coffee spill and how people have jackpot justice and jackpot verdicts and doctors leaving the state to the states who don't have caps, that is to say limitations on liability.
and the like. Here, what caught my attention, and I was talking to Dean about it, was there's an article in a very prominent peer-reviewed journal. Now, a peer-reviewed journal, as not everyone in the audience may know, is the kind of journal that your doctor would read in his office or in his or her leisure concerning various important topics to the physician. And there's a peer-reviewed journal where doctors review other doctors' information entitled CHEST. It's the pulmonology journal or the chest surgeon journal. And an article's written by a physician lawyer, not by a lawyer with a stake in the game, so to speak, but it's entitled Five Myths of Medical Malpractice. And so it's important because this is not just any old op-ed piece in the Inquirer and the Daily News or somebody mouthing off. This is a physician who carefully looked at the data and came up with five myths. And I thought it would be fun to talk about them, and Dean and I kicked it around, and I'm certainly here to have a discussion.
Well, listen, the number one myth, okay, in medical malpractice litigation right now is that attorneys, what we do, the litigation, the suing of doctors, the bringing them to the court to really to honor their contract with their patient, that actually is exploding. That there's a lot of litigation out there, and that's causing a lot of bad things to happen in the medical industry. What about that? Is there an explosion of litigation?
To the contrary. While it's not in this article, which I'm sure we'll get to in due course when we go through the five myths, because we wouldn't want to disappoint anyone listening about what the five myths are and how they're just myths, not reality. But, Dean, in Pennsylvania, the facts are the exact opposite. And I don't have the statistics exactly in front of me, but it's close to this. Since 2002, medical malpractice filings are down roughly 40%, I believe as much as 60% in Philadelphia County. That's because about 10 years ago, there were changes made that make it extremely difficult, more onerous, harder to recover, and as a result of which, the lesser cases, the cases that are more questionable, really were pushed out of the system. And so what we have left with is a lot fewer cases in Pennsylvania and, frankly, nationwide.
Yeah, I was reading an article in the Legal Intelligencer just in the last couple of days, I think, that said that the medical malpractice filings, and that's, folks, when you bring a dispute to the court, when you're not able to resolve it amicably, which is probably 99.9% of the time, when you bring a dispute to the court, you begin by filing a lawsuit or complaint, and it's very easy, and then those complaints are codified so that the ones that deal with motor vehicle accidents have a specific code, those that deal with medical malpractice have another code. Very, very easy now for the system to count how many medical malpractice lawsuits are filed, and it is down, and consistently year in and year out it has dropped for the last 10 years.
Well, that's right, Dean. And there's a number of interesting things going on. The number of cases filed against physicians has gone down. By the way, I believe, and I've been doing this now for, this is my 35th year, and I have seen some changes in safety in medicine. And I believe that systems are in place in medicine. And I believe that there are some better precautions taken, which does account for some of this. But a lot of it has to do with the fact that cases are now filed on what's called a certificate of merit, which is a lawyer, before he or she files a claim on behalf of an injured patient, must swear to the court with his or her law license on the line that he has medical backing for the case. That's made a big change. And so all these cases are pre-vetted before they even get into the court system. And that's changed the numbers. On the other end of the spectrum, and those who complain bitterly, oh, it's jackpot justice, there are cases that are filed all the time. time and the plaintiffs with their winnings. We've all heard all of this propaganda and all of this kind of advanced rhetoric. The fact of the matter is that something like 80% of cases, I think it's 75 to 80% of cases in Philadelphia County, are defense verdicts. It's very hard to win a medical malpractice case. By the way, that's why you need absolutely fantastic legal counsel who's able to guide you through the system and able to get a recovery. Someone like MyPhillyLawyer.com.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things I wanted to mention about what you just said, Tom, is that that's one of the things about this article, I think, that we as lawyers need to do more of is get this information to the public. Because one of the big disasters, I think, is the statistic that you just gave, which is 80% or sometimes even more in certain counties of the cases are defense verdicts. Not because the cases aren't valid and not because the cases don't have merit, but because the jury is made up of people who've heard these myths and just think, you know, I'm not giving money to these people. It's going to make my doctor leave. It's going to make my insurance costs go up, blah, 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 blah.
And Dean, it's very important for people to recognize that valid claims in the hands of competent and skillful attorneys are still valid claims and still recognized in the system.
Sure.
And my experience has been that while there have not been jury verdicts in many counties, for example, just 2 days ago, our law firm, fine young lawyer in our law firm, Dave Inchko, had a $1.7 million jury verdict in a very meritorious case in Bucks County. There had not been a plaintiff's medical malpractice plaintiff's verdict in Bucks County in, since anyone can remember. And the fact of the matter is that that's an important factor, that if you have a meritorious claim, you should seek good, competent, skillful legal counsel. And if you do, if you call Dean Weitzman, you will then get someone who will talk to you, who will know these issues, and who will be able to vet them for you.
Right.
Thank you, Tom. Tom, what was the greatest myth that you saw in this Chest article? Number one myth that we need to debunk.
They all stand out. The one I've been talking about, the one myth that's debunked here is that the tort system delivers, quote, jackpot justice. That some people get filthy rich when people see the aberrant verdict, a verdict that's out of the ordinary. As the authors point out in the article, the news covers fires, building collapses. That's a whole other story, Dean. disasters, airplane crashes are covered. What's covered is the jury verdict that some jury awards $50 million, and it grabs the attention of the press, and therefore it grabs the attention of those who would destroy the rights of people to bring civil claims in America. That's what they jump on. The fact of the matter is, as pointed out in this article, those types of verdicts are few and far between. They are the airplane crash, if you will, of the system, and they are almost always corrected by the court. The person who gets that kind of award often doesn't collect that kind of money, and it goes on to say an interesting fact that people don't understand, which is most of these awards are limited by, in some ways, as a practical matter, by insurance coverages or the limitations of a system. So that's one myth that's prominently talked about in this case, that the tort system delivers, quote, jackpot justice. We hear all the time, as I said earlier, about the McDonald's coffee case, even though it's not a medical malpractice case. And by the way, your viewers should rent on a DVD or through the internet a great movie called Hot Coffee.
Great documentary, yeah.
Which is a terrific movie. I think you've talked about it on your show.
Yeah, we have.
And then, so that's one myth. Another myth is that physicians are running away and moving out of states. There a few years ago in Pennsylvania, the obstetricians mounted a campaign that they all were moving. I don't know where. Eventually, you run out of states if everyone's moving. But the theory is that if the legislature will cap damages, then doctors will be more comfortable and be able to stay. And here these doctors examine the most draconian state in the legislature has so restricted the right to sue. And by the way, in California, it's the same way, believe it or not, the state of California.
So in Texas, there's a cap on damages of $200,000, I believe, that the most you can collect is $200,000 for pain and suffering. And
no matter what your injury,
no matter what the injury, no matter what the effect on your life, no matter how catastrophic the consequences have been, you are limited to $200,000.
Yes, keep in mind that our legislature saw fit to do that in 1980 to all victims in municipal cases, which is another horrible thing which I've come on and talked about, and I won't repeat other than to say. It's wrong. These caps are wrong. Caps encourage bad conduct. They encourage people not to stay in the state, but they encourage those who stay in the state to remain here. And if there's no consequence to your actions, you won't be careful, is my theory. Or you won't be as careful as you have to be, or no one will care. This myth here, however, takes it just a nudge forward. Dina, and then we'll be through two of the five myths, which is doctors will leave unless there are liability limitations on their damages. And that, if you study it, if you actually look at the statistics of states like Texas, like other states, you will find where there are limitations on the right to sue, more restrictive than in Pennsylvania, the doctors neither leave or come any more frequently than they did before.
Tom, with that, we're going to take a quick break for our sponsors. We'll be right back. I hope you can stay on the line. Yes?
I'm yours till you need me to leave.
All right. We'll see you back here in 2 minutes. Hold the line. If you've been injured in an automobile accident, you know what matters. Being able to afford medical care, providing for your family while you're out of work, knowing your rights and getting just compensation. These things matter. That's why your attorney matters. I'm Dean Weitzman from My Philly Lawyer. If you've been injured in an auto or truck-related accident, My Philly Lawyer will fight for you. Call 215-227-2727. My Philly Lawyer, when winning matters most.
If you've been injured, the road to recovery can seem long. At United Therapy Centers, we're here to help. Call us 877-510-7764. With leading-edge technology and our team approach, we provide the highest level of patient care with a pain management program developed just for you. If you've been injured, we can help. Call United Therapy Centers toll-free 877-510-7764. United Therapy Centers, get on the road to recovery.
Are you in a financial legal squeeze? Unable to work because of an accident with your legal case still not settled? Lawsuit Funding Solutions can help you pay the bills while you wait. If you have a pending lawsuit, call 877-697-7352. It can take time for a lawsuit to settle. Lawsuit Funding Solutions is here to help you get back on track. And you won't owe them a thing if your case doesn't settle or you don't receive a judgment. Get out of the squeeze today. Call 877-697-7352.
If you've been injured on the job and are entitled to workers' comp, you need someone fighting for you from the start. Call Jeffrey Gross, attorney at law. Don't rely on your employer or insurance company to get it right. Call 215-512-1500. If you're entitled to workers' comp or it's being challenged, Jeffrey Gross can help get the money you deserve, and he won't get paid unless you get paid. Call 215-512-1500. Jeffrey Gross, attorney at law, representing Pennsylvania's injured workers for more than 20 years.
Need more legal answers? Here's more Court Radio with your host, Dean Weitzman, on Old School 100.3.
Good morning, folks, and welcome back to Court Radio. Joined in the studio with my co-host, David M. Rappaport.
Good morning.
Hello, Dave.
Hey.
And we're joined on the line with Philadelphia's only, one and only, Tom Klein. Good morning, Tom.
Hey, good morning again.
You know, folks, we're talking about medical malpractice. We're talking about the myths that have been propagated by those who want to injure you. Well, they don't want to injure you, but they don't want to pay the consequences or suffer the consequences of the injuries that they've negligently caused you. And they want to try to get out from under that for as little as possible, give you as little as possible. And most people, unfortunately, don't pay much attention to this until they're the victim of medical malpractice. We're going to talk about the myths with Tom Klein, but first, I got to talk to a couple callers who have been waiting patiently on the line. Shane from Camden, New Jersey. Shane, you called last week and we didn't get a chance to get to you, and I apologize. Turn down your radio, and Shane, give us as quickly as possible what it is you're calling about.
Yes, hello.
Good morning. And, oh, by the way, Shane, if it applies, happy Father's Day to you.
Thank you. Same to you.
Thank you, Shane. Go ahead. What is it you're calling for?
Well, I have a business problem. I went into a verbal and written agreement with a deli, with a convenience store owner for me to take over the deli, to bring the deli up to par, and he promised to sell me the property by paying rent. And I started in there like 3 weeks ago. In the first week I started, I got shut down by the Department of Health because the guy didn't want to have a dumpster. But first, let me say, he leased the store to another guy. He never let me know that he leased the store. Now this other guy, he comes into the store. He don't have a dumpster. Department of Health shut me down for like a week. Then he managed to get a dumpster after I threatened to get one. And he's always wanted to look in my register. And I don't feel like I have no agreement with him. I don't have to discuss my business with him because I didn't make no agreement with him. I made my agreement with the owner. And I wanted to sue the, I wanted to sue the owner, which is an Indian guy. And the guys that he got in there now, they're putting me on the line with doing a lot of illegal activities so far as with the food stamps and this, that, and the other.
Here's what I'm going to tell you, Shane. Here's what I'm going to tell you. Anytime you're making an important business decision, an important agreement, that you're going to have to live by and you want somebody else to honor, you really need to get the advice of an attorney and get that in writing, something that you can actually take to the court and enforce at a later date. And you're gonna invest money and your time, your life into this process, and it sounds like it's a mess, like a hot mess. There's a lot of moving parts going on here. You got some tenant, you got somebody taking over the building, and you're depending on a lot of different people involved in this. And you know what? Most of the time, clients come to our office to have a consultation about this stuff, and it's, you know, it's a small price, but it saves you a lot of headaches in the long run. And there's attorneys at my office that do that kind of thing, that represent people who own small businesses, and they create contracts for them. So by all means, give us a call during the week. 215-227-2727. We'll be happy to steer you in the right direction, but this is definitely not something that you should go alone. All right, Shane, have a great Father's Day, and thanks for calling Court Radio. Tom, we're back with you now. I'm wondering what, you know, I want to just preface by saying before we get into myth number three, I invited Richard Schmidt, MD, onto the show. Dick Schmidt is hey, what's funny about that?
Nothing. You, okay. You know, you just said.
All right. So anyway, Dick Schmidt.
It's like Beavis and Butthead.
Dick Schmidt was invited onto the show, and he declined to come on. And he was representing the physicians in Pennsylvania who would like to see some more tort reform.
Yeah, he's a proponent of tort reform, a vocal proponent of tort reform.
And not so we couldn't get Dr. Schmidt on, and so we called several other doctors. Would you believe not a single solitary doctor had the gumption or the time or the wherewithal to come on to talk to us, you, me, David, about tort reform and about these myths?
Well, I'll tell you what they could say or couldn't say. Maybe I should take their place today.
There you go. Okay. Go for it.
But they would tell you that there is defensive medicine that we have to practice. That would be, and by the way, that takes us to myth number three. I've taken them out of the order of the authors of the article. By the way, to give credit, the article is Chess, and it's Five Myths of Medical Malpractice, And the lead author is David A. Hyman, who is a University of Illinois physician and lawyer, and is also part of a place called Centers on Lawyers, Civil Justice, and the Media. They would tell you, among a few main arguments, that you have defensive medicine being practiced. That would be the first thing a doctor would tell you. We order these CAT scans, we order MRIs, we order tests because we know that the hoof sounds of the lawyers are not far behind. That would be the argument. The fact of the matter is, and it's right here in the article Chest, is that, and by the way, Chest 213, for those who are writing it down, 143 paren 1, pages 222 to 227. I'm not making this up. And the doctor would say, we practice defensive medicine. The truth of the matter is, and therefore that drives up the cost, and therefore all of us pay all of these costs of all of it that's going to go to the lawyers, when the truth of the matter has been for years that a small percentage, something like less than 2% of all costs are associated with medical malpractice claims and medical malpractice costs. And by the way, this article goes to point out something that we intuitively know, Dean, but which is not known by the general public, which is that something like 20 cents on the dollar that's paid in all of these medical malpractice claims are paid to the lawyers for the hospitals and the doctors to defend the claims. So there's a cost built into the system, but the cost is not significant overall. And the study debunks the myth that doctors practice defensive medicine, which in turn drives up the cost. The costs are the same in the capped states as they are in the non-capped states. And that would be what a doctor would tell you. And unfortunately for his or her argument, that's what I would say in response to Dr. Schmidt or anyone else who came on to tell us that.
So no savings, there's no cost savings by being in Texas versus by getting your medicine in Philadelphia.
That is essentially correct. Nor are the doctors moving out of town. The only thing that's happened in Texas, and I happen to know this from other studies which I've read, states which cap malpractice claims, they do so because then they say the premiums are going to go down. Well, let me tell you something. What happens here is that the premiums remain the same or higher, and the payouts of the insurance companies are lower because they have a cap or a restriction on the amount that can be paid. And who's the winner there in that situation?
Right.
Insurance company, yeah. As always.
And so it becomes a shell game of let's create a myth, let's have people buy the myth, then they will restrict the right to sue, then we will still sell insurance, and the insurance will cost as much or more and will pay less out. By the way, in Pennsylvania, unfortunately for consumers, a few years ago, the amount of coverage which is required by any healthcare provider, that is to say, any doctor who you go to is required to carry an amount of insurance, and the amount was restricted down from $1.2 million to $1 million. And that may seem, oh, who cares, it's only $200,000. That's a significant reduction in a claim, which is a significant claim, where that's the only real coverage or real recovery that someone can have, which takes us to one of the myths that the authors of this article talk about, which is that doctors are worried personally, become bankrupt. He describes it, and we're now on myth 4 of 5, physicians are one malpractice verdict away from bankruptcy.
Let me ask you a question about that. Have you ever sued, recovered, and collected the assets of an individual as opposed to the assets or the coverage that individual has purchased?
That is something that never to exceptionally rarely happens anywhere in America. And as for me personally, I can remember one case when I was a very young lawyer of a doctor who was uninsured and who did the wrong thing and who broke the law because the law requires him to have insurance. And even there, he paid his patient a very modest, very, very modest settlement. And that was, in my recollection, 30-some years ago. It's unheard of, essentially. It's threatened by lawyers a lot, frankly. It's something that is part of the give and take of the mix of the discussions in settlement among lawyers. But the fact of the matter is that almost always, and this article proves this point statistically, 90-some percent of the time, 99.999% of the time, a doctor essentially has no liability, and certainly has no liability if he or she has done the right thing and purchased the coverage, which is required in Pennsylvania under the law. And thank goodness for Pennsylvania citizens that we have that going for us, that we have a requirement that a physician is insured. A physician, a midwife, a chiropractor, anyone who is in the healthcare industry has that kind of coverage. Ironically, and I believe wrongly so, lawyers don't need that kind of coverage. And frankly, I think we should have mandatory coverage.
Thought to myself that in 25 years of practice, it happened one time where I collected the assets, the personal assets of actually a lawyer who had committed legal malpractice and did not maintain malpractice insurance. And again, it was in the grand scheme of things, it was a nominal sum. But I've had many clients come to me, many clients over the years, where I will effectuate a settlement, a resolution, and the insurance company on behalf of the doctor or whoever the negligent party was will offer the policy limits, let's say $1 million. But clearly my client's claim is worth more than $1 million. My client will say to me, well, can't we get the $1 million and go after the assets of the defendant at the same time? And the answer to all of them has been no. No, we can't, because if you sign a release, the insurance company is not going to offer up that $1 million policy without your signing a release protecting their insured and giving up your rights to collect anything more. So you have to make a choice. You go forward with a chance of losing in litigation and giving up your right to collect, or you pursue in order to pursue the assets of the individual. And frankly, it's pretty easy for folks to avoid having to pay a judgment, even if one is obtained.
Well, that's right. One of the things in Pennsylvania is, for starters, if a physician is married, the physician is likely to have his or her assets in joint names, and joint name assets are not attachable or attackable, so therefore the physician is essentially judgment-proof. Now, we have a change in all of this, which is worth talking about for at least a few seconds, and that is, as more and more health care is delivered by larger institutional entities, as the hospitals and health care systems buy up practices, and the doctors are employees of the healthcare system, so we less and less have these issues, frankly. We have large institutional interests who are, in some cases, billion-dollar, and for some other cases, multi-billion-dollar companies that are doing business and providing healthcare within Pennsylvania and New Jersey and the surrounding, your listening area right now. And the fact of the matter is that those corporations have the assets, have the wherewithal, have the insurance, and have the ability to pay claims when someone is significantly injured. And, of course, the sad tragedy in America has always been, and maybe always will be, that if you're injured by someone who has the wherewithal to pay, you're going to be fully and fairly, at some point, compensated if the system works. But we have those instances where people with $15,000 in an automobile policy hit you in your car. And I don't want to morph into auto cases, but the fact of the matter is that recovery is based on, to a large extent, the ability to pay.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's move on to myth number four.
Oh, I think we've covered, by my checkpoint here, we've covered, here's my checkpoints. Let's recount. I was a sixth grade school teacher for 6 years. I've taught in graduate school and law school, so I'm giving, since I'm the professor here this morning, I'll I'll keep track.
Yeah, school us.
The tort system delivers jackpot justice. We've disposed of that.
Yes.
Because it's not true. Physicians are one malpractice verdict away from bankruptcy. We've disposed of that. That's not true. Physicians move to states that adopt damages caps. We've disposed of that. That's not true. Tort reform will lower health care spending dramatically by reducing defensive medicine and the like. That's not true. 0-for-4, Dr. Schmidt. We go to number, see, as long as he's not here, we might as well talk about it.
Why not?
And then number 5, which is, in my view, kind of self-evident. Malpractice crises are caused by spikes in medical malpractice litigation. There's sudden rises in payouts and claims frequencies. They argue, oh, you know, you have these bursts of litigation. Well, there's some truth to that in a very, very kind of micro way. You can see that when some horrible disaster happens. I remember, for example, at St. Luke's Hospital, you had the nurse that was found. It was on 60 Minutes a few weeks ago, again, there was a nurse who was clearly killing patients. Although there were many defenses to those claims anyway. Well, this whole spikes in medical malpractice litigation, I actually pulled the statistics. I've lectured on this topic. Actually, I'm going to be lecturing on this topic before our state trial judges in Hershey at their upcoming conference. They've asked me to speak, and this is one of the topics I'm going to talk about. Here are the facts in Pennsylvania. I mean, they're so dramatic. They're the opposite of any spike. In 2000, Dean, there were 2,632 claims, medical malpractice cases filed. 2,632. Keep that head in that number in your head. You know the number filed in 2011, and I haven't even added the 2012, which are less. 2011, 1,528 filed, wow. Down 44.1%.
Does that mean that Pennsylvania is a safer place for patients today? I mean, is that part of what's going in here, that the doctors aren't maiming and killing like they used to?
I think it's in part a somewhat safer environment, hardly a totally safe environment. There are mistakes that are made. Human beings are human beings, and mistakes are made, and the best of intentions by the best of physicians can sometimes result in a mistake, and that mistake should be compensated, in my view, and I know you share that view. But what is happening is that there are fewer claims because medical malpractice claims, not in the hands of very skillful, very competent, very experienced lawyers, are just too expensive, too difficult, and aren't being pursued. The fact of the matter is, and this article in Chest speaks to this point, the fact of the matter is that in Pennsylvania as well as elsewhere, many people who are injured, in fact, most people who are injured, don't even bring a claim. They walk away from it. They love their doctors. They believe that malpractice litigation is not something they want to get involved in, which is hard, difficult, long, costly, and emotionally upsetting. So most people walk away. And I believe what you see happening here, however, in Pennsylvania is a direct result of the need to vet cases first. A lawyer like you, Dean, or me, needs to have a qualified physician, and we have to then sign a piece of paper swearing that we have a case and it's a bona fide case. And that's knocked a lot of cases out of the system.
I remember actually being able to file without that. There's a lot of things going on. I mean, joint and several liability, folks don't even understand that when there's several doctors involved in your care and their individual actions culminate in malpractice, but one may have a very small piece of the puzzle. It used to be that person would be responsible like the one who has a larger piece of that puzzle. That's not the case any longer in Pennsylvania, and that's knocked cases out.
That has. But everything that we're saying here today should not discourage some listener who has some loved one, some family member who has been a victim of what they believe to have been poor medical care. There are poor outcomes, and a lawyer like you or a lawyer like me will tell someone that you have had a poor outcome A doctor can't be held negligent. There are risks to medical care. Make no mistake about it. But you need to have a kind of lawyer look at the case who would know and understand what it is. Our backdrop here today is to say that the five myths, which I now have out on the table, which we've now knocked down, that these five myths are myths, and that when you hear people at the next Phillies game, when you're in the bar talking about lawyers and malpractice, and oh my word, the lawyers are the curse of the and evil of the world, and the doctor, my doctor is leaving, or my doctor won't give me care, or my obstetrician tells me that she can't deliver my baby. It's all a bunch of BS. It honestly is a bunch of stuff that has no firm, sound, logical basis. Having said that, it is my Tom Klein view, which I know is shared by Dean Weitzman, is that if you have a real claim, you should go to a real lawyer to have that investigated, because within the context of all of this, there are claims which are valid and people who have meritorious claims which are being compensated. I do want to put a footnote to this whole thing, because I happen to have the numbers in front of me, and I know some audience members and you, Dean, would be interested in this. The MCARE Fund in 2000 paid $341 million in claims, 2000. In 2011, MCARE paid $170 million in claims. That tells you half
as much in that period of time. And folks, the MCARE, just so you understand, the MCARE fund is a fund that all doctors pay into for the eventuality that they may have to dip into that system to compensate victims of their malpractice. So every doctor pays a little bit into the MCARE fund every year. That fund distributes that money to the victims of malpractice. And that happens on December 31st of every year.
Yes, and to give you just another couple of statistics, I took the statistics. I've ripped them apart, actually, for an upcoming lecture that I've had. I've looked at them very carefully, and it's very interesting. If the medical malpractice win-loss rate in some of the counties in Pennsylvania were the Phillies, we'd even be more disappointed than we currently are. In Delaware, in 2010, plaintiffs, and I think I have my statistics correct here, are 1-14. In Philadelphia, by the way, you know the myth that Philadelphia is the center of jackpot justice?
Right, right.
My 2010 number, plaintiffs in the courtroom were, if I have this right, 8-26. And
wow.
In 2011, they were 11-25. Why? And they not only would Charlie get fired, but Dean and Tom would get fired.
So more than half the
plaintiff's medical malpractice so-called jackpot justice winners look like the Marlins. They are in 2010 30-133 in malpractice win losses, and 32-110 in 2011. I put them in this way to kind of shock people into the fact that we don't have jackpot justice. Medical malpractice cases are difficult to win. So what is the takeaway here? Because I think it's important not to go away on a takeaway that's negative. The takeaway that I have is that these cases are difficult. These cases are, but there are meritorious cases. There were 30-some cases that succeeded, that didn't settle, that went to a courtroom, that a jury in Pennsylvania in 2010 did say were meritorious. So what do you need? Presentation. You need excellent lawyers. You need the best of doctors to come to court for you. And you need the best team possible to try to get yourself the justice that you or your family may deserve. That is an important message.
Yes. Thanks, Tom. Thanks. We really are, unfortunately, bumping up against the time. We have to get going. We can't thank you enough for joining us at Court Radio today. Happy Father's Day, and I'll see you soon.
Happy Father's Day, Dean, and to everyone there. Take care.
All right.
Okay, thanks.
You too, Dave.
Yep, thank you.
All right, guys. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, and we're going to have to pass the baton, as they say, to my friend, and a happy Father's Day to
Happy Father's Day.
E. Stephen Collins E. Stephen. And Philly Speaks coming up right after this.
If your child suffered a birth injury, you know what matters. Getting proper medical care, counseling and assistance, knowing your rights, and getting just compensation to provide for your child's future matters. That's why your attorney matters. My Philly Lawyer is ready to fight relentlessly for you and your child. Call 215-227-2727. Choosing the right legal representation is critical to getting yours most.
If you've been injured, the road to recovery can seem long. At United Therapy Centers, we're here to help. Call us 877-510-7764. With leading-edge technology and our team approach, we provide the highest level of patient care with a pain management program developed just for you. If you've been injured, we can help. Call United Therapy Centers toll-free 877-510-7764. United Therapy Centers, get on the road to recovery.
Are you in a financial legal squeeze? Unable to work because of an accident with your legal case still not settled? Lawsuit Funding Solutions can help you pay the bills while you wait. If you have a pending lawsuit, call 877-697-7352. It can take time for a lawsuit to settle. Lawsuit Funding Solutions is here to help you get back on track. And you won't owe them a thing if your case doesn't settle or you don't receive a judgment. Get out of the squeeze today. Call 877-697-7352.
If you've been injured on the job and are entitled to workers' comp, you need someone fighting for you from the start. Call Jeffrey Gross, attorney at law. Don't rely on your employer or insurance company to get it right. Call 215-512-1500. If you're entitled to workers' comp or it's being challenged, Jeffrey Gross can help get the money you deserve, and he won't get paid unless you get paid. Call 215-512-1500. Jeffrey Gross, attorney at law, representing Pennsylvania's injured workers for more than 20 years.